Okay, so like last week, I'll just I'll ask if there's any questions. We did not have a very long time for questions and discussion last week at the end of the lesson. So if there's anything that you wanted to bring up and maybe didn't have the opportunity to, we can start that way, and that way we can hopefully build off any knowledge that you don't feel like you have today. So anything like that? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they also are, I don't know, they try to say you need to know the Quran? Because it seems like a confusing book to me, maybe because they don't understand it fully.
Yeah. From what I've found, it doesn't seem like most Muslims will have their devotions, so to speak, and use the Quran because it's not easy to read, and it's also not really arranged by topic, and that actually makes it really difficult to study from my point of view, because there's like a bunch of different places that a topic is discussed throughout the different surahs, so you can't necessarily just kind of park in one and get all that information. And it also changes from surah to surah, even if it's the same topic is brought up, it seems like it's brought up in a different light. So they would probably just to get more of it through teaching, it sounds like, as opposed to reading. I'm hoping that I can show the conversion video that I referenced last week, because we're talking about the five pillars of Islam, and one of those is that point of conversion, so saying the Shahada. So hopefully we can show that, and in that they give resources to those converts, and I don't remember if they give them a copy of the Quran or not. And I'm feeling like they don't. I feel like they just give them study materials, which I think would kind of support my idea that it's not. There's certainly a lot of Muslim scholars that know the Quran extremely well. It just doesn't seem that, you know, the general population would quite as well.
It would be subject, they would be at the mercy of whoever's doing the teaching, and you know how that can vary.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and it really does. Yep. Yeah. You just have to realize that much like Christianity, and I use that term broadly, Islam is extremely similar. Okay? There's different people follow the religion to different degrees. People take different doctrines of the Quran differently. And that's why you can't necessarily associate all of Islam with, you know, like Al-Qaeda. And you can't associate all Islam with people that are very strict about certain things, because they're not. And there's a lot of groups of Muslims who aren't really all that serious about the five pillars. They may fast during the month of Ramadan, but that may just be the extent of how they live out their Muslim faith. And that, I think, sometimes catches us off guard, because we just kind of assume that they're all this very fervent, convicted people. But it's the same with every religion. Every religion is people that follow it to varying degrees. And I would say that Christianity, broadly speaking, they don't know the Bible very much either. And so if I had a Muslim that asked me that, I would probably respond in the same way and say, I don't really think that people have their devotions. Like, there's not a lot of personal accountability anymore with a lot of Christians, which is an unfortunate thing to say. It really is. But I think that we can say that pretty confidently. The vast majority of Roman Catholics, you know, are how much do they actually know their Bible? And I would say probably not a whole lot. Well, obviously not a whole lot, or else they probably wouldn't be Roman Catholics anymore. So yep.
Just like a daily bread. I didn't realize they did that. So.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm trying to present with Islam, because there's so many misconceptions about it, especially among Christians and Americans broadly. But the reverse is absolutely true. Where most Muslims have an incredible misconception about Americans and Christians. So you have stereotypes that are stereotypes for a reason, right? Stereotypes exist because most people are like whatever the stereotype is. But within that stereotype, there's still a lot of degrees of that. And so Christians view Muslims incorrectly a lot of times, and Muslims view Christians differently a lot of times. And so finding a scholar on the Quran that will actually have knowledge of Christianity, that's where you can actually start to have discussions and very intelligent conversations about it, because they can actually correctly recite the Bible. But you know, that generally speaking with Muslims, they're going to think that you believe all sorts of stuff that you would go, I don't actually believe that. And I think the reverse is true. All right, I'm going to see if I... Yes, go ahead.
Are they really, all of them, as strict with their prayer time? And how many times a day is it where they're supposed to bow down to Mecca, facing Mecca, and that kind of thing?
I believe it is 3 times a day, morning, afternoon, and evening. As far as the level at which they... like what percentage of Muslims actually do that religiously, I wouldn't have an idea. I think that there's probably, you know, a lot of them do, because it's a very tangible way to live out their faith. But I think, you know, some of them, you know, maybe they just pray once a day, or maybe they just follow that a couple times a week. Again, the varying degrees. Some of them are going to be extremely devout and follow it to a T, and they'll observe the month of Ramadan with, you know, a lot of fervor. Others will observe the month of Ramadan and not really. Like I read this week in my study, some Muslims, so they're supposed to fast completely, food and water, throughout the entire day. But then once the sun goes down, they can eat and drink. And so some of them will be very devout in the way that they observe it. And they'll observe it like it's a normal day. So they get up and they, you know, would go to work and they'll do their prayers, and then they will not eat or drink the entire day, and it's the waking day. And then they'll eat before they go to bed, and then they'll, you know, start all over. Some of them will actually just sleep the whole day, and then at night they can, you know, make merry and you know, have these feasts, and it's more like a celebration. So you can see how that would be a whole lot easier to observe the month. You're still observing it, right? Because you're fasting. It's just that you're sleeping for a decent portion during the day. And that was kind of interesting to me as well, that, you know, you can even observe something that's... It's actually one of the 5 pillars is fasting. It's observing the month of Ramadan. So even within the pillars, the things you're supposed to follow, people just observe it differently. So is it not discovering it?
It's Bluetooth searching for it.
Huh.
I don't know why it's not.
Well, we just have the worst luck trying to get sound for anything.
Let me turn it back on.
Bluetooth connecting.
It's not like pairing to your phone, is it? Automatically?
No, my phone's in the back. Pair your phone to it if you have the audio on it.
Oh, yeah, that's true. See, it's supposed to be discoverable, right?
It's in pairing mode, so.
Well, let's just see what happens here. The SRS one? Let's see if it works. Okay, so my phone's connected. Now we're going to go through the fun of trying to start the video on my phone at the same time we started on the screen, because I'll have to hit it at the same time. I'm not texting someone, just so you know. If you hear my phone, my wife get a notification on her phone, then you know I'm lying because I'm texting her. Right? The reason I'd like to show this video is because it's going to give you a firsthand. It is in and of itself a primary source because it's firsthand knowledge, exposure to how Muslims do live out their faith. But while I'm getting everything set up, I'm going to go ahead and start today's lesson. So what we're talking about today is how Muslims actually live out their faith. And we're starting with the five acts, commonly referred to as the five pillars of Islam. The first one is to witness, and that is the Shahada. So this profession of faith, which I discussed last week, it's stating that Allah is the only God and that Muhammad is his prophet. And I pointed out last week that it's interesting how it's required that you point out that Muhammad is a prophet in the Shahada, but you don't have to talk about any of the other prophets. So it's very important to understand that the pillar of Islam is Muhammad. And even though Muslims themselves will not say that Muhammad was the founder of Islam, they don't like using that term because Islam is the one true religion of the one true God, according to them. So if you have somebody that just is the founder of it, that's a person, then it makes it sound like he just kind of came up with it, okay? Which is probably going to be the point of view that we're going to take because we're Christians. And we would say that that's not the one true religion of the one true God. Our religion is that. And so would we say that Abraham is the founder of our religion, of Christianity? Is he the founder of it? No. Would we say that any man actually founds our religion? No. We would say the foundation of our religion is the existence of God and his son, Jesus Christ. So we're kind of in the same boat as them in which we don't want to point to one individual person and say, this is the reason that this religion exists, okay? The second pillar of Islam is worship. Okay? And I have there in italics the Arabic word for each of these. This is most commonly practiced through the ritual prayer. And what that looks like is it's a set sequence of motions and prostrations performed facing the direction of the Kaaba in Mecca, and accompanied by brief Quranic recitations. How many of you have heard the Muslim call to prayer? Like whether it was maybe in a movie or at any point in your life, just kind of heard. Yeah, usually it's over a speaker. And if you're in the Middle East and you're in one of these Muslim countries, they will have that call to prayer at every point in the day at which you're supposed to be praying. And so they'll observe it pretty regularly, going back to your question. But do we have Muslim call to prayer in most American cities? Well, no, because in most American cities, the majority are not Muslim. Okay, so it's really up to them then to observe that time of prayer throughout their day, and whether or not they're able to do that is pretty much just up to, each of them. Okay, I think I got it. Okay, the third pillar is fasting. Okay, and each Muslim is expected to fast during the month of Ramadan. There are some unique exceptions, but what's interesting is that Muslims do not like observing these exceptions. The exceptions are men that are at war, children that are too young to really be able to observe it, and women who are pregnant. So that kind of makes sense that those folks wouldn't be able to necessarily fast. And there are actually quite a few allowances within the Quran for a lot of these. And you'll find that the same thing is true with the pilgrimage. Every Muslim is supposed to make the pilgrimage to Mecca, to the Kaaba, and there's certain rites they're supposed to perform while they're there. But the exception to that is if you're able, so some Muslims may not be physically able to make the trip, and you have to have enough money to make the trip. So if you're not financially or physically able to make the pilgrimage, then you're exempt. So it's kind of odd that we have these five pillars, but again, there's exceptions to practicing them. It's not like an absolute, you have to do this. So does that mean that Islam is more of a faith-based religion as opposed to works? No, it's not. Because in each individual Muslim's life, their good works are supposed to outweigh their bad works. Okay? So even though you may not have specific works that you have to carry out, maybe sort of like the Roman Catholic Church, especially in the more traditional sense, where there's certain things that you have to do to stay in the church and retain your fellowship with the Roman Catholicism, Islam is going to say, you need to do this, but we also understand that there are scenarios in which you're not able to accomplish it. Okay? I actually brought up the other day that there are too many Muslims in the world today to actually make the trip to Mecca. So like mathematically, it's impossible because you cannot have that quantity of people at any point in their lives actually descend on Mecca, because you have Meccans there, and Mecca is a city in and of itself, and then you have this massive population of Muslims in the Middle East that are able to make the trip. And so how do you have millions of Muslims around the world? They can't necessarily just fly into Mecca and this is during the 12th month, they can't actually practice it. And so, again, we have that allowance, this idea that there are some Muslims who may not be able to fulfill these pillars. Okay. One note about the Muslim calendar that's also going to be important with this pilgrimage piece is that the Muslim calendar is a lunar calendar that has 12 equal months that total 354 days. So Ramadan is not observed at the same point in our calendar. Okay? And they don't have any leap year. They don't have any extra month. There's no way for them to make up the 11 days and actually 12 days that we have in our calendar year. It's just 354 days, and that's how the Muslim calendar goes. So every year, it moves up in our calendar 11 to 12 days, and that's why I say at some points in the year, depending on where a Muslim lives in the world, it's going to be a lot easier to observe this fasting, because if it falls during the winter months, it's not as much of a burden to go without water for the whole day because the temperatures are cooler. You can imagine that if it's summer in the Middle East and it's the month of Ramadan and you can't drink any water, the sun is out for a longer period of time, again, depending on your location, but the heat is, and so it would just be interesting, I think, to find out how many people who are trying to observe Ramadan end up getting hospitalized because of dehydration and malnutrition and these things, because they're trying to observe it during a month that is extremely strenuous on the human body to go without water and nutrients. Okay, the fourth pillar is tithing. And this is not going to necessarily be in the same sense that we tithe. It is giving to the needy, but the fundamental idea of it is more like sharing. So you have Muslims that are able to give more, and you have some Muslims that aren't able to give very much, but each Muslim is expected to give of what they have to help those that are less fortunate. And sometimes this is practiced a little bit more as a community. So there's a bunch of different ways that they can actually fulfill this pillar. It wouldn't have to necessarily be monetarily. You could be sharing with your time, with your food, with your house. You could, as a community, say, we need to build a new mosque. And so everybody just kind of pitches into this common pot. And so this community can now build a new mosque. But in the establishment of tithing, it actually was more like a duty. It was a tax that was imposed on the tribes that Muhammad had conquered. And then once he takes his reign over this part of Saudi Arabia, it's the respect, right? It's paying the tax to the king in the Middle Ages. A very, very similar type of setup where you need to show reverence to the ruling class, this Islamic political class, and you do so by paying this tax. Today, even in a lot of Muslim countries, it's not taxed. Okay, so it's not something that's going to be taken out and sort of forced upon people. It's my understanding that the Mormon church does something along those lines, where it's really more like a religious tax than it is a voluntary giving of what you have. It's an expectation, and they'll just take it. Now, that being said, some of the Muslim countries today that are a little bit more conservative, and again, think of that term more in a large context, so they're extremely staunch in their beliefs, they're actually going to something that looks like a little bit more of a tax, where they're making people observe this pillar of Islam by taking it out of their paycheck or things that they own. So once again, this is a pillar that is expected to be fulfilled by Muslims, but the way in which it's fulfilled is sort of left up to different people. Okay. Now, tithing for us really means almost exclusively the giving of money. And the word tithe comes from this idea of giving a tenth, which comes from the Old Testament. But it's not as though pastor or the deacons or those that count the offering are running percentages based on how much we make a year and making sure that we give at least 10%. It's a very personal thing for us where we give, we make a promise or we make an offering to God, but it's really just between him and us, and we give of what we can. And that's fulfilling more of what Jesus taught in the New Testament, which is, you shouldn't be public about your giving. You shouldn't blow a horn when you, give at the temple. It should be something that you do almost privately, and it's what you can, okay? And so, you have the widow and her two mites. She's giving more than the person who's giving quantity. And so we don't really give based on quantity. We give on what God lays on our heart. So this is, a similar concept that we have in Christianity, but also the way that it's carried out is still quite a bit different as well. Do you have a question, Mr. Pierce?
History in England and the United States made it very clear that forced giving was very much a part of the very early United States. There were taxes to fund government-supported pastors here in the United States, and the Baptists were the main ones that did not like that. Mm-hmm. And they, once the Revolutionary War was over, it was Baptists that got that Bill of Rights, and that was a very real part of that separation of church and state.
Exactly.
The government's not going to tax the people to support a common pastor. People are going to make those choices themselves here in the United States.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And something that, once again, Christianity as a whole is a very personal religion. True Christianity, it's very much about a person's personal relationship with Jesus and personal relationship with God. And that's why the question that Mrs. Unruh asked about, do they do their devotions? How do they live out their faith in a personal way? It's very difficult to answer because Christianity is so very, true Christianity, again, is so very unique in the sense that we have Bibles. And we all bring our copy of the Bible with us. And we read from that copy or multiple copies of the Bible personally. And then we come to church and, you know, the pastor shares what God lays on his heart from the Bible. But again, what we do with that message is what? It's very personal. Okay? The pastor is not going to say, you know, give you a list of things. Now, I preached on this subject, and so now for you to prove to me that you learned something, you have to do X, Y, and Z. Right? The way that people live out Christianity is extremely personal. And that's why people of other religions don't really understand that. That the accountability is very, very personal. Right? Each one of us are going to stand before God, and God is going to judge each one of us personally. Okay? And none of us is going to be able to point to anybody else and say, well, it's because of this or that. Okay? You have to have a personal relationship with God, and you're responsible for your spiritual growth. You can't say it was the pastor's fault or your parents' fault or anybody else's fault. Okay? So these pillars of Islam, again, they don't really have a comparison with Christianity, even though the words may sound the same, just because of the way that they're lived out. Christianity is lived out very differently than the way that Islam is. Okay, so now we get to the pilgrimage. This is the fifth pillar of Islam. It's known as the Hajj, and this is the pilgrimage to Mecca in the 12th month of their lunar calendar. So again, the pilgrimage is also going to be at a different point in our Julian calendar throughout the year. So if you're expecting to be able to say, you know, every December, which is our 12th month, there's going to be this mass of people that descend on Mecca, that's not the case. It's going to be at different points every single year and moves up, you know, a week and a half to almost 2 weeks. Okay. One interesting thing that I found out about the pilgrimage in my study this week is that it seems as though a lot of the rites, and these are rites would be like the practices to show that your pilgrimage is, you know, being fulfilled. It seems like they originate in a lot of the pagan rites that were practiced at the Kaaba, which again leads us back to what we've talked about in earlier lessons, where Islam appears to be an interesting and unique combination of pagan Arab polytheistic practices, like the belief in genies, for example, that are now meshed with these distorted views of Judaism and Christianity, and now you have this very, very unique belief system. Okay? So some of these rites are, in fact, based on incorrect Islamic belief that concern Abraham, Ishmael, and Hagar. And the way that they practice these is pretty unique. And I'll read from the concise history so that we get a kind of a picture of what that looks like. So these rites, and I'm quoting here, these rites include circling the Kaaba, kissing the black stone set in one of its walls, physically running between the nearby hills of Safa and Marwa, stoning a pillar near Mina, representing the devil, sacrificing sheep there, and assembling on the plain of Arafat. Some of the rites may have begun as pagan practices, like I said before, but Muhammad reinterpreted them in monotheistic terms, which is the same thing that he did with the Kaaba, the physical Kaaba, this black stone that has the box built around it. And you can, I'll try to include a picture next week so you can kind of see what it looks like when it's empty, and then you can see what it looks like during this time of pilgrimage. And then continuing to quote here, thus Muslims believe that Abraham and Ishmael found the black stone and erected the Kaaba around it. So Muslims believe that Abraham and Ishmael, not Isaac, Abraham and Ishmael found this black stone. They erected the Kaaba, which is the temple portion of this location. They erected this around it. And then what happened was that the Arabs, the polytheistic idolatry Arabs, then corrupted this location and made it something that it wasn't. Okay? Now, we don't find any of that in our Bible. And in fact, the Bible records that Isaac was the chosen son, not Ishmael. Right? So this is, again, where the Muslims get this idea that the Arabs are the chosen people of God and not the Jews. And they say that the Torah is corrupted in saying that it was actually Isaac or Israel that was now he's the descendant of Abraham, that and that's God's chosen people. Muslims say, no, Ishmael, the son of Hagar, he was chosen to continue Abraham's line, and it's Ishmael that the Arabs come from. Now, we don't actually have, and I think that there's some misconceptions that among Christians that Ishmael actually is the father of the Arabs, and that is kind of why the Muslims are such a thorn in the side of the Jewish people. We don't necessarily have any lineage that supports that idea. Ishmael is, he does end up fathering the different tribes in Canaan that oppose the Jews, and so you do have that conflict, but it's not necessarily that the Arabs as a people themselves are directly descended from Ishmael, because they can't really prove it, and we can't necessarily disprove it. It's just something that they believe. But what we can say is that in their saying that the Torah is corrupted, in saying that God chose Israel to be his chosen people, we say that the Quran is corrupted in saying that it was Ishmael. And so all of these rites that take place at the pilgrimage, they're based on Abraham, Ishmael, and Hagar. So why do you run seven times between these hills? This commemorates Hagar's frantic quest for water after Abraham had expelled her, and Ishmael from his tent. The sacrifice of a sheep recalls Abraham's binding of Ishmael. Did Abraham bind Ishmael and attempt to sacrifice him on Mount Moriah? No, who was it? Isaac. But they say that it was Ishmael. Okay? So the sacrifice of the sheep recalls the binding of Ishmael at God's command in the last-minute sacrifice of a lamb provided by an angel. So we all know that story, but we go, something's weird. That's not the right son. The day of sacrifice is a high point of the Hajj and the occasion for a major feast throughout the Muslim world. And the pilgrimage rites have served throughout history to bring Muslims together and to break down racial, linguistic, and political barriers among them. Right. So it is a time of unity among Muslims. But yeah, interesting. And you really have to understand that portion of Islam, this belief in Ishmael being God's chosen, the root of God's chosen people, to understand the rest of Islam. It's an important root. Yes.
I did have a chance to witness to a Muslim that I worked with at one time, and I had prayed, I can remember specifically praying what to say, and that came to my mind, the difference between Ishmael and Isaac, and mm-hmm. when I pointed out that is a picture of Christ being willing to die for us on the cross for all of our sins, Islam had no answer to that, no comparison. Even though they say it was Ishmael never
but there is
was
no
a picture of Christ.
Sacrifice there.
Exactly.
Because they don't believe that Jesus was crucified.
Right.
Yeah. So those are the five pillars. But there seems to be a sixth pillar, and it's something that we've already discussed somewhat, but I want to make sure that it's completely clarified. And that is this idea of jihad. Okay. Jihad, the word itself, means to struggle or to exert. Okay? And the reason I want to talk about this word specifically is because we have a very specific connotation. So when I say the word jihad, what do you think of? You don't have to raise your hand. What do you think of?
Holy war.
Terrorists, holy war, right? We think of the different terrorist attacks. Those are labeled as jihadist attacks. Okay? But in the Quran, once again, this concept is a little bit unclear what exactly this word means. Is it actual physical violence that's supposed to be carried out? Or is it just, as I have there in quotation marks, a struggle in the way of God? Okay. So this is a quote from Cook in this Christian commentary in the Quran. In the Quran, the root is not the root word, which is J-H-D, the root is not the primary locus for fighting and warfare, but conveys a range of different meanings. The Quranic material from the root, and there it is not very large, and as a religious, political, and military concept, jihad does not seem to be singled out as important within the text. So very often, when you find this word jihad, there's a lot of different innuendo into what it can mean, okay? It does have broad interpretations. Okay? And Muslims that are not associated with terrorist organizations would say that this is very similar to our struggling against resisting the devil, you know, resisting the influence of the world. And again, that word in its root, that's what it means. Jihad does not mean holy war, does not mean holy violence in Arabic. It just has this idea of a struggle. Now, that doesn't mean that every time that it's mentioned in the Quran, there is not physical fighting that's discussed around it. But once again, we run into this issue with the Quran where it's very nonspecific and very it's left open to this interpretation that makes it difficult for us and for Muslims to nail down exactly how you're supposed to live this out. Okay? So if you're a non-violent, non-aggressive Muslim, as most of them truly are, then you're just going to say that, you know, jihad, I can live out this portion of my Muslim faith in my struggle against idolatry, in my struggle against unbelievers, in my struggle against influence from the outside world, and that is my personal jihad. That is my struggle. That's my exertion on behalf of my religion. Okay? But that doesn't mean that jihad, it does not mean violence. Because, as I quoted from this commentary before, fighting and violence, independent of the word jihad, is actually talked about very frequently. Okay? So just remember that the word jihad, if you're talking with a Muslim and you use that word, okay, if they've been in America, then they're going to associate that with terrorist attacks and so forth like you would. And I would say that even a lot of Muslims in the Middle East, because of our idea of what that means, they're still going to know that we have a misunderstanding of it, or at least in their minds we have a misunderstanding of it. Okay? But if you use that word at its core meaning in the Quran, it doesn't necessarily always mean fighting a war on behalf of one's religion. Okay? So when does it become violent? Okay. Well, in Surah 9, it approves the annihilation of idolaters unless they convert. Okay. So this idea of fighting on behalf of your religion does say that you could annihilate these people who are idolaters. Now, idolaters, they are people that would be those outside of the specific people of the book who are Jews and Christians and Muslims. Okay, so you have these three Abrahamic religions that are not considered, and there's going to be a major exception to this later on, that will not be considered idolaters in this passage. And in this passage, Muhammad is saying, you can kill these people after, I think it's a four-month period. Okay, so that you have to know the historical context. This is after the move to Medina, right? These people that are polytheistic, that are pagan, give them a time period where they can convert to Islam. If they don't convert, then you do have the right to kill them, and you can lie in wait for them and ambush them and kill them, and that's okay. Okay, so he makes this distinction. Now, is this in historical context? Or is this a universal commandment? Once again, it's very difficult for us to know how that's supposed to be interpreted, and it really just depends on how a specific Muslim or a group of Muslims is living that part of the Quran out. Because you can certainly see how some groups of Muslims would say, this gives us license to kill people who are unbelievers. And you can also see how some Muslims would say, well, in the historical context, as the Ummah, the group of Muslims that are living in Medina at the time, they're in a time of war. And Muhammad is saying, in this period of war, you are supposed to kill these people who are enemies. Okay? And they would say, because the Quran specifically says that God does not look kindly on the aggressor. Okay, so basically, if you can find a reason as to why you're the defender, you're defending yourself, then fighting is good and it's okay, right? So you could see that there would be kind of some different ways to interpret that too. So what makes something an aggression and what makes it not an aggression, okay? But you have to take the historical context into account when you interpret this, and most Muslims will say it's just about this period of time, okay? But what about Jews and Christians? Because like I said before, these people who practice idolatry are not necessarily referenced as Christians and Jews, because usually the Quran points out that Christians and Jews are the people of the book. And so you have this specific terminology that's used for us, right? Except this, okay? To many Muslims, these accusations justify fighting against the people of the book. And I'm not going to try to pronounce his name, but this is a Quranic scholar, a commentator, who says, this is his blunt declaration, this is an enticement from Allah Almighty for the believers to fight the blaspheming, idolatrous Jews and Christians. So here we have a commentator on the Quran who is now associating Jews and Christians with idolatry and saying that because they're associated with idolatry now, then these commands about being able to annihilate people that practice idolatry applies to the people of the book. Okay? And there are a few portions of the Quran that reference idolatry and Jews together and also seem to present the beliefs of Christians as idolatry as well. Right? The belief in multiple gods. That's what they believe that we believe about the Trinity. Okay? So this justification, again, is not very far-fetched. It just depends on how you're going to interpret the passages. Okay? So this specific commentator would say, fighting against idolatry, violent fighting against idolatry is justified, and because Jews and Christians, in his mind, practice idolatry, they fall under that group that can be annihilated. Okay? And that's an important thing to understand that some Muslims will associate. Okay? Now, this is not, again, I don't want to paint with a broad stroke and say that all Muslims are going to agree with this commentator. But Islamic terrorism is a thing. Okay? And as much as the AI that I consulted to help me construct my lesson plans would like to deny it, it's something that has to be taught on. Did I tell you guys this story? No. Okay, so this will be the last thing that I'm able to talk about, which is good because it's the last pillar. We're going to talk about the beginning of the empire next week. So ChatGPT is an AI program that is extremely helpful to me and my job because we handle all the communications. And in communications, you have to come up with a lot of content that you're going to put out so that people know what's going on. And you can just kind of plug in a little bit of information into AI and say, hey, I need a post about X, Y, and Z. And then it'll give you something that's very detailed. And you don't have to sit down and write something out for 30 minutes or kind of figure out a strategy to accomplish something. It can just kind of give you some suggestions. And then you can do what you want with the information. So typically what happens, you know, is we'll give it a little bit of information about what we need, maybe an article that we need to put up on the website to inform people about a construction project. And it'll write something for us, we'll copy and paste it, and then we'll do our own editing to make sure that it's actually correct. Okay? But then the actual body, like the real meat of the article, we don't have to sit down and spend hours and hours making sure that, you know, we're typing this out letter by letter. So it actually is a very good tool. So I need a lesson plan, right? And I'm going, okay, so how do I structure my lesson plan? You know, my unit plan, so to speak, about Islam. You know, what topics do I need to make sure that I cover? So it's just a simple question, you put it in AI. I think it came up with 9 different lesson topics for me. Not a single one referenced Islamic terrorism. And so, me being the cheeky person that I am, I asked AI, why didn't you include anything about terrorism? Because that is, you know, something that needs to be discussed when you're talking about Islam. And it apologized. It was like, oh, you know what? You're right. And so here is a 10th topic or another topic that you can talk about. And Just guess what the focus of that lesson they wanted the focus to be on. Misconceptions about Islamic terrorism. And again, I'm in this conversation, I'm too deep, right? So I'm just trying to just pin this AI on stuff. And I'm like, what is the misconception? Exactly. Are you saying that terrorist attacks don't happen? And that people don't fight wars in Islam on behalf of Muhammad and Allah? You're saying that that's a misconception? And so we just kind of go back, and you know, it's an exercise in futility because it's not a person, it's just something that's been programmed. But it's a tool, and it is, in some cases, just entirely useless, right? So if you are a 15-year-old that's writing a research paper about Islam, you're not going to get a single piece of information about terrorism, right? Because that's, can't really talk about that, right? That's a difficult thing to discuss. So why are we talking about it so much? Because, I mean, in a lot of my studies, this is considered one of the jihad is the sixth pillar. It's something that Muslims have to practice some way in their lives. And some Muslims, at least a decent enough number of Muslims, that it's something that happens on several occasions and somewhat consistently, is that a decent number of Muslims live it out by killing other people. Right? So if you don't address that, you're missing a significant and very influential part of the entire religion, right? Okay, because just because 1.6 billion Muslims don't practice terrorism, okay, what's the most influential part of the religion? The extremist wing that's made up of a decent number of people, okay, and all you have to do is look up the footage of Muslims in different countries that come out by the thousands to protest and chant death to America, okay? There's a larger number than people wanna admit, right? So, but that's the expectation now of scholarly sources is that, well, that can't really be a lesson topic, right? You can talk about everything about Islam, but you can't talk about terrorism. So I just thought that was interesting. And needless to say, I've utilized books a lot more moving forward. Okay, we got time for a little bit of questions if anybody's got one. Yes?
So is it true that the terrorists that have bombs on them and all that, that they think that if they kill people that hits them?
Mm-hmm.
Some rights in heaven or mm-hmm.
No, there is definitely a belief among those that are, you know, suicide bombers or, I mean, a lot of them are, I mean, they're entirely okay. A lot of the terrorists that are members of these organizations, they're entirely okay with dying because to them, death is the reward. That's when they go to their reward and their life is nothing but to be lived and sacrificed for the cause, for Allah, right? So yes, they absolutely believe that. And that's what motivates a lot of people that we would not associate with terrorists. So people that are relatively successful in life, how do they get roped into terrorist attacks? Because it's not just these poor people that live bad lives and don't really have much hope. Right? It's people that are somewhat successful in Islamic worlds and they still get roped into these extremist ideologies and then they'll carry out these attacks. So they definitely believe that there's something religious to it. There's a religious component to it.
I understand that they teach the children in school that they need to fulfill this terroristic thing and that they are promised the highest place in heaven when they do that. And not only that, they are aiming to do that.
Yeah, so that's going to be in the countries like, you know, where Islamic governments have the most control, especially terrorist organizations like Hamas, where Hamas has control, or Hezbollah, north of Israel, they have control in Jordan. In those locations, yes, they're taught that. In other Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia, they're not going to teach their kids that. They may teach it about it, but they're going to teach about jihad in a historical context and talk about the warriors for Islam like back during, you know, shortly after Muhammad's death and the expansion of the empire. So they'll view that in a favorable light. But again, we have to make sure that we're accurate in how all Muslim countries are educating their youth. Not all of them are educating them that they need to be terrorists, but a significant number are. Okay, not a majority, but a significant number are. There's a lot of people that live in, you know, Iran. There's a lot of people that live in Jordan. A lot of people that live in Syria. So are all of these children being kind of indoctrinated into this extremist ideology? A lot of them are. Yep. Okay, we got to close. So let's close in prayer and then we'll be dismissed.